this isn't a podcast that you're listening to. I don't know where you got that silly idea from. Goodness me, no. This is a radio show. I suppose we've not done a podcast for years. Don't think about it. Just go and put your head down and just, I'll deal with it. Hello and welcome to episode 132 of Ribbon of Memes. A not podcast where we don't interrogate films previously described by other liars as masterpieces. I am not Nick, and you've never heard me, and I am not joined in this episode by Not Roger.
I'm sure it'll all make sense. Just calm down, don't worry your pretty little head about it.
And we are discussing Gaslight. And Gaslight. Because these are the films that, they became, what do you call it when a title becomes a verb?
Denominalization.
Denominalization. They are the original term for where gaslighting originated. Gaslighting being someone deliberately making you feel that you are wrong and you're imagining things. And basically undermining your own sense of sanity and reality. And these are the textbooks for it.
So once again, we note that if, as people sometimes ask, remakes got banned, we wouldn't have the version of this that everybody accepts as the best one.
Yes, very good point.
See also the Maltese Falcon.
I'm not against remakes per se. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because you've got reactions, oh, why bother? Because the first one was always good. But I think there's enough examples of the exception that sometimes the original's better, sometimes the remake's better. It doesn't hurt to give it a try. Though in this particular case, the 1944 Gaslight, the Hollywood version, attempted to utterly destroy all versions of the 1940 version, which was the British version. Mm. But thankfully failed. So now we have both versions. Now, which one do you want to tackle first, Roger? They're very broadly similar. Yeah, that makes sense. They're both from the same play.
Yeah, so the play is 1938, Gaslight as Two Words, by Patrick Hamilton, who was quite well respected author and playwright. Sadly drank himself to death in the 60s, but...
Didn't we all?
Yeah.
No, we didn't.
Yes. But in any case, the basic plot is the same in both.
Yes. Let's discuss the 40s version, and then we can just sort of touch on how it differs in the 44
yeah,
version.
Yeah, so the names differ, but in any case, Alice Barlow, famous singer... He's murdered by an unknown man.
Quite graphically, I suppose this is how, you see kind of actual, this is sort of the areas of the era of the motion picture code, but I suppose British films weren't
They had the British censor, but that was a different set of rules.
So we see an actual murder on screen of a woman being strangled until she's dead. Which it struck me as out of place for a black and white film, probably because I'm used to watching motion picture code films.
And so there is a frantic search of the scene of the crime.
Yeah, slashing open of upholstery and searching behind curtains and a lot of stuff.
The house light stands empty for several years and then a nice young couple moves in. She is, as it turns out, the niece of the murdered woman. Which is why they have access to the house.
She wasn't in the 1940 version, I believe. I think that's a change in the 44 version. Right. In the 1940 version, they are just a couple that are moving in. In fact, I think the apartment where the murdered woman was upstairs.
She is the niece in the play.
Okay. So, well, this is a change in the film. They're not. They're just a couple. And actually, the murder... flat is the top floor that is sealed off in this version, I think.
Hmm.
It's a small distinction, but it does become relevant, I guess, in the 44 version.
But in any case, she is already a bit nervy, one gets the impression.
Now, she in this case is Diana Wynyard?
Yes, Bella Mallon.
Yeah, she's a delicate and, nervy in the kind of Jane Austen sense of a delicate constitution, I suppose.
And her husband, Paul, is basically encouraging her in this, and he this is a thing we'll come back to, but he right from the beginning, he is clearly coming the, you must be perfect, and that therefore you are bad, and therefore I won't take you out in public, and all the
rest
of it.
He is, to put it in not too fine a term, he's a dick right from the start. Mm. I mean, he's just an absolute arsehole.
It's like the thing one sees in a lot of stories of couples who, to some extent, are unhappy, which is one wonders why they got together in the first place. Presumably he was more charming at some point, but he certainly isn't
now. Yes, but
now.
We never see that. He's telling her right from the outset she's always losing things and she's imagining things, and she's an embarrassment to him, and he's disappointed by her, and he's just constantly undermining her. He hates a dog, the bastard. and he's very he is also, and I can't help but notice this is also true of the 1944 version, a foreigner.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, I don't know whether that's deliberate or not. I would contend you don't have to be a foreigner to be a dick. it quite often helps if you're not.
but in any case, there are these various little things, you know, she's looking after a brooch of some sentimental value, and then it's suddenly missing when he says, well, why don't you get it out and wear it tonight? That kind of thing.
Yes. And when he does throw her a bone, and this happens in both versions, but there's a moment when he's like, well, you know what, let's go out tonight. But he deliberately sets her up for a fall, because she gets very happy, she's very excited, and he knows full well that he's going to ruin the evening by then asking, well, where's that brooch? Mm-hmm. But quite quickly,
just in case you were in any doubt of his utter villainy, he's flirting with the maid who is clearly no better than she should be.
she is a promiscuous maid, you might say. I was going to say, quite quickly in the 1940 version, we see, I think this is a difference, we see that it's him pocketing this stuff, and that he is lying to her, and he is undermining her sense of reality. So when he says, oh, you're always losing stuff, we know for sure he's actually taking it and then making her feel like she's losing it.
The key thing, it's interesting that the key thing that gives the story its name is not actually part of the plan at all. Which is that there are times when the gaslight in Bella's room is dimming. And this is in fact because, in this case.
And this is why you have to set it specifically in this period, just pre-electricity.
Yeah. This is because the husband is in fact sneaking into the attic conducting an ongoing search, but obviously he needs light to do that.
Yes. And so when he does that, it dims the gas supply in the house below. But crucially, when she says, oh, did it get dimmer? Is someone else turning the lights on? Everyone's like, no, what? We're the only ones here. That's another one of your bonkers things, you bonkers lunatic.
Yeah, one interesting thing is the housekeeper, cook, I think she is technically, Elizabeth. Yes. He's clearly not a conspirator in this, but she just probably didn't notice the light dimming or whatever. Oh, it happens all the time. I just don't notice it. I'm just trying to remember the names because they do change from version to version. When Bella talks to her, she can't help either.
And she seems kind-hearted. She's also, however, clearly bought into this narrative that the mistress is a bit delicate and sometimes imagines things. And so I think that's why she believes. Well, again, in the 1944 version, I think it's explained that the cook is really deaf and very hard of hearing, which is why she doesn't notice all the clomping about. It doesn't quite explain why she doesn't notice the dimming, but I think you're right. She's just not very observant.
Also, just thinking of how pressurized gas flows through pipes, you would expect the biggest effect to be closest to the new valve that's just been opened.
Which would be where the wife, which in this case,
and she is directly underneath the thing, and she. But part of the point of this is that she does not really believe that he's hearing footsteps in the flat above, which she knows perfectly well is empty after all.
Yes, exactly, and she knows that she's hearing things. There's a scene. You mentioned the open flirting. Where the husband openly flirts with the maid. Right in front of her, clearly just to upset, in front of the wife, in front of Bella, just to upset her. And in this version, you know, the maid is much more openly up for it, I guess. You know, she has a line like, "You're mine now, aren't you? Because you want me." And she's clearly very happy. But it's all more subtle in the 44 version.
Well, bits of it are more subtle, bits of it are really much less, but
yes, yeah, okay, yes. We also have, as a sort of side narrative, we have, I keep thinking of him as Thick, I don't know why, but it's Rough. I don't know why I'm mixing up Thick and Rough. It's possibly because Thick is one of the constables in From Hell, Alan Moore's story of the Jack the Ripper murders. In fact, it's Constable Thick and Inspector Godley, and Alan Moore says, if Thick and Godley don't sum up the police attitude at the time better than anything else, I don't know what is. Anyway, that's a side issue. Ruff is a ex-detective who spends his time now grooming obviously fake horses. I couldn't help but notice how little that horse moved while he was grooming it. This is something that is a bit, perhaps slightly better explained in the 40 version. He takes an interest in the new house. Was he involved in the previous murder investigation? I don't think he was. I don't think he mentioned
it. Not in this version, no. Oh, he was at least attached to it, but...
Yeah, so he's got some sort of history maybe there. But he takes an interest in the house. What is the excuse for him suddenly becoming very interested in the comings and goings of this couple? I can't quite remember.
I think it may be that he sees Paul and think, hang on, I know that bloke. He was involved in the investigation into the murder which happened in this house. He has no possible reason to be back here. Except...
It might be. I think in both versions that the reason for him getting involved are more tenuous than I would like. Or his counterpart in the 44 version. But yes, I have to admit, he's a very watchable character. So this is,
Frank Pettingill, ooh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a very watchable actor, isn't he? I mean, he's just, really, you could argue this character, in fact, I think there's a strong argument to make that this character in both versions weakens the plot a bit because it gives a sort of lifeline to Bella, an external lifeline that proves she's not going insane. Well, we can talk through what he does, but I have some issues with
before that. Somebody who isn't really in the second version, her cousin, Oswalter?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And he's being put off by Paul. And
yeah, Paul's basically saying, "No, you haven't got any letters. What are you talking about?" And pocketing them,
and throwing the guy out of the house.
Yes,
and played by a young Robert Newton.
Oh, interesting!
Not using his natural accent.
So they get suspicious that something's wrong. Basically, Paul is blocking all access to the outside world. Ruff has realised something's up, and he starts trailing Paul, and he realizes that he is going out of the front door and coming in the back door. Now, here's where I'm going to get mixed up between both versions, but he ends up, does he go through the skylight in both versions?
No. In this, he's only got some hints, but It's mostly happening when Paul is out. Ruff comes to the house to talk to Bella, and look around a bit.
That's right.
And
there's this moment that we don't see on film, but she said a few times, "Oh, this all started when we moved into this house." Specifically, when you got that letter for somebody or other. and I can't remember, because again, the name changes between the versions, and you were very angry.
Louis Bauer.
You change. Yes, Louis Bauer. And of course, he's like, what letter? There never was a letter. That's why I got angry, because you imagine the whole thing. But they find the letter to Louis Bauer. Do they in this?
I don't think this version starts opening the desk, but doesn't get anywhere with it.
Yeah.
Paul/Louis obviously comes back.
And it turns out that
Help yourself. Have a look through my desk. I've got nothing to hide. But what he has got to hide is the missing brooch.
Yes. And once Bella's seen that, it falls into place that he's actually been bullshitting, or as we now call, gaslighting her the whole time.
Also, this version, the brooch is in fact the one with the secret compartment that rubies are hidden in.
Well, yes, and it has, yes, which he didn't realise. They're what he's been looking for the whole time. Because it turns out he is a jewel thief as well as a murderer, and he was the one who done the nasty murder in the first place, and he wanted the jewels that this famous singer, she's still a famous singer in the first film, yeah, isn't she, had. And the whole motive for him moving into this house is to have access to the flat above so he can get the jewels. And when he's found the odd trinket, he's handed them on to Bella. And he's covering these nefarious activities by basically gaslighting Bella into thinking she's imagining it. It's also strongly implied, frankly, that he just enjoys the power play of it.
It's broken a bit because if she's not connected with the house... Mm. Then why does he need to marry her in order to get access to the house?
Yes, I think this is a flaw with this version, is couldn't he just move in as a bachelor? And then he doesn't have to do all this weird stuff that he's doing to convince her she's wrong, because he wouldn't have any risk of escape. And I suppose the argument is, he just likes doing it. Maybe they genuinely did get married for fun. For love. And maybe he did like her at first, and he's just such a personality that he enjoys doing this. And I think...
Well, I mean, we do establish it in both versions that he's already married to somebody else in Australia.
Oh, yes. It doesn't count
if it's in Australia.
Well, it does mean that he's a bigamist, which means they're not actually married at all.
This is one of those attitude of the time things, because being married to a criminal is terrible, but if she wasn't really married, then that's all right.
Yes, I do think that is a bit of a convoluted way of saying, don't worry, it's not as bad as it seems, and she won't have to get a divorce because they weren't married in the first place, because heaven forbid such a thing would happen.
Yes, she's only a loose woman of having slept with a man she wasn't married to.
But it leads to this beautiful scene. Basically, he's been tied to a chair. It feels a bit convoluted. He's been tied to a chair and left in with Bella. So Ruff has figured all this out now. He didn't go in knowing it. He's not Sherlock Holmes, but he's figured out the plan. They've subdued him, and he tries one last time to work his magic on Bella, who this time is not having it. She gets a knife. I thought this was going to go into a much darker place, I have to say. So she picks up the knife, ostensibly to cut his bond, but then says, is it a knife? Oh, no. Or maybe I'm imagining it. I do tend to imagine these things, you know. So I thought she was going to then stab him to death while saying, oh, you're just imagining me. But she did. Maybe that's just me having watched a lot of Coen Brother films. But we get this nice comeuppance of her asserting herself basically throwing off his yoke and becoming a confident person again. So it's a good story, and it's well done, and I enjoy it. Should we talk about the differences? Because in some of the ways, the flaws of this film are in some ways corrected by the 44 film.
Yeah, I mean, there are things I want to come back to here. But the 44, basically MGM spotted that the 1940 British version had been a success, and indeed the play had been a success. So they bought the remake rights and then got in this clause that all existing prints of the first film should be destroyed. They do seem to have tried to destroy the negative as well.
Is that a standard thing? Like, not particularly, did that happen with another film?
I think it may be just because it was relatively close in time.
It seems odd, though. It's not like anyone's going to be watching it on video at home, so it seems odd to try and destroy evidence of the competition.
Yeah, I mean, this was the era when films would get re-shown in cinemas.
Right, so, yeah.
Possibly.
Anyway, this is an all-star cast. We have, I like Diana Wynyard. I think she's very good, but in this version we have Ingrid Bergman. And we have Charles Boyer. And now, I'm not particularly familiar with Charles Boyer, but I was very impressed here, I have to say. Instead of rough, we've got Joseph Cotton as a sort of random American detective. Well, it's never explained that he's American, but he's
working
American.
For Scotland Yard. He just talks like Joseph Cotton.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the key differences here, aside from the acting and all the names have changed, are one, as we've alluded to, this is actually Paula in this version. This is Paula's childhood home. And she was an orphan. She was brought up by her aunt and she found her dead in this house, which is a key. That's why she left.
Went off to study to become a singer in her aunt's footsteps.
Yes. And then we have Gregory, Charles Boyer, kind of courts her there in Italy. And he's actually...
Yeah, he's explicitly her accompanist here. And indeed, he admits that he knew the aunt. He was her accompanist back in the day.
Yes, that comes out later on. But I think what the film does well here is establish that he's actually charming. You know, he really can be charming, that they do seem in love and you believe it. So we actually get the early part of the romance here before they move into the house. And he's very good. It shows a really nice bit of manipulation where, like, he clearly needs to move into this flat because he's got, you know, spoiler, the same motivation as the character from the previous film. He's looking for jewels. It's slightly different here in that it's not a separate flat in this one. It's all the aunt's stuff has been moved up into the attic. And so he needs to go into the attic to search for the jewels every time. But it's a nice bit of manipulation early on when he's like, where would you like to live? And he sort of politely prods her towards, oh, you know, I always wanted to live in London in a square. And she's like, oh, I've got a house in London in a square. It's nicely done in that it's more, seeing the earlier part of it, it's more believable
The whole repeated pattern of bringing up a thing that is supposedly something she's done wrong and then saying, oh, well, don't worry about it, it's fine. Which is obviously a whole lot more effective because, you know, I'm your friend, I'm just telling you this for your own good.
Yeah, just so you know.
Rather than the previous version where he's simply constantly having a go at her and telling her she's useless.
He's horrible. This film also has a disturbingly sexy Angela Lansbury as the promiscuous maid, Nancy. Some of the scenes are like verbatim, presumably straight out of the play, like when he's openly flirting with Nancy, in front of Ingrid Bergman, whatever she's called in this one, Paula. I think that is a key difference. The other difference with this version is, although we kind of know what's going on, you never actually explicitly see it till the end of the film. It's still possible, you know, you don't see him pocketing the stuff and making this stuff up. You know he's doing it, but I think it's wise not to explicitly show it, so it can still kind of pretend maybe she is imagining it, you know. The one thing that doesn't quite work for me in that version, in this version though, is that in this one the cook comes up, she says, well, so again, we've had Joseph Cotton visit her, and it's really, in this version, I have no idea. It comes up with a pretty tenuous example as to why Joseph Cotton becomes obsessed with this couple.
Well, this is explicitly, he has seen Bauer, but he was involved in the previous investigation.
Yeah.
And then, why is that guy walking around?
Yeah.
Well, the answer is because you couldn't pin it on him last time, mate.
It doesn't. Well, also, and he's like, oh, and I saw your aunt, and you look just like your aunt. It's a bit tenuous because he's. Anyway, when he's been in and he's done exactly the same thing that Thick Ruff, Ruff does, the chef comes up and says, oh, no one was here. You imagined that. But She didn't. I don't know quite what the logic
is. I think the idea there is, when he came in, he's explicitly said, don't tell anybody I was here. And she says, yes, it would be my job if I let anybody in. So she's sticking to that. And I'm not going to tell anybody you were here.
Okay, that makes sense.
It does have the effect of knocking Paula a bit sideways.
I think what this film gets better is the emotional, you know, the emotional manipulation. That Charles Boyer can be charming and he can be absolutely awful. And he does both those things on a dime. And so you're, just like Ingrid Bergman's character, you are kind of on tenterhooks as to which way he's going to go. And that scene repeated here where he says, oh, let's go out tonight. We'll go to the theatre. And he does that basically just to mess with her. You know, he's just horrible about it. In both versions, it's there. But I think it works much better here in that Ingrid Bergman is, she's a really good victim, I'm afraid to say, that she acts it really well. She just gets the emotion much better. And when she's collapsing towards the end, you know, there's a moment where she just does this scream of horror, which I suppose you could argue is overacting. But I don't think he just gets this sense of this person's world just collapsing, and she can't. When she screams, when the gaslight dims, and she's screaming for the maid because she can hear, for the chef, she can hear the noises. It's just this howl of kind of primal horror, which I think it brought me along. I thought she was phenomenal in it. I think the two leads are just better here. I think that's really what makes. I'm not sure about Joseph Cotten. If I had a choice, I'd rather have Inspector Ruff turn.
Well, I think part of the problem here is because he is being placed as a romantic lead. At the end when she's safely on the market again. But because of that, he loses much of the personality that Ruff had. Ruff had his interesting quirkiness because, you know, he's not needed to do any other jobs apart from being the investigator.
Yes. It slightly undermines Joseph Cotten's character's kind of motives in that you're like, is he really, you know...
as a little boy, I was in love with your aunt and you look just like her. It's perhaps not ideal.
It's on the creepy side, isn't it? But again, we have the same... again, here it's slightly different. As I say, he's been creeping around the attic this time. But the same gimmick is that the gaslight dims and everyone says, oh, Joe, don't be silly. But we have, again, this really good scene at the end where... she turns the table on him. He's tied up again, for some reason, tied up to a chair, even though they're about to take him out.
To hold him while the policeman goes for the cops and the carriage to take him away and so on.
Just to prevent. Yeah, okay, I'll buy it. But it leads to this. Is this a dagger I see before me? No, I'm imagining it. Moment which I think it's just played better here. I think it's not Diana Wynyard I dislike. I think it's the male actor that doesn't convince for me.
Well, I would agree with some of that, but I think that specific scene works better for me in the 1940 because I got a genuine feeling that she was perhaps about to stab him and that he was afraid of it. Whereas in 1944, that doesn't seem to be on the cards.
No, I absolutely agree there. Yes, I really got shades of, oh my God, she's actually going to kill him in 40s. But I suppose my issue with that scene in the 40s version is he's so unpleasant about it, even when he's tied to a chair, that I just don't believe that she would even be convinced for a second. Whereas he turns on the charm in the 44 version and you almost believe, actually, maybe she'll go for it. There's a lot to like in both these versions of the film. I have some issues with the plot in general, which may be coming at it from a 2024 perspective, in that it is a shame that we need an external figure to rescue the woman in both cases. I mean, these are...
Yeah, well, see also Halloween, which just misses having a final girl by having some other guy turn up and save the day.
Yes, exactly. Donald Plummer. I'm always happy for Donald Pleasance to turn up and save the day. But it's just a shame. I mean, I suppose you could argue without this external
Well, she needs something, but it doesn't need to be an actual person.
It would be nicer if she managed to find a way out herself, if she'd found the brooch herself.
Yeah, let's say for some other reason she has to break into the desk.
Yes.
And then maybe sees the brooch is there.
And Nancy having an affair or something. But yeah, there'd be ways of doing it. And then she would be able to sort of complete her emotional journey herself. You could argue without that external character, it's actually a pretty grim story, pretty depressing. So having a character who's away from that environment is actually a relief to the audience because you're stuck in there and it's quite oppressive.
Mm.
But I do think it's a shame. I suppose the other issue I have with the plot is Alan Moore, he comes up a lot, said in V for Vendetta or in his preface to V for Vendetta, the one mistake I made was thinking that you would need a nuclear war to push Britain into fascism. And I feel a bit similarly here in the sense that I don't think you need to be a jewel thief to behave like that towards a woman.
Well, yes, I think part of that is to give the guy a motivation other than I'm a bit of a wimp and I'm not actually any good at relationships.
Yes.
Which sadly, is far more common in actual domestic violence, going along with, well, this is what I met as a child, and therefore I assume it's the pattern, which sadly works on both sexes.
Well, I think that's my sadness, really, in that, you know, this thing does happen a lot, all the time. It's just, you know, most guys don't have the excuse that, oh, I want to get to these rubies in the attic or whatever. They're just dicks. And I, in a way, I find that a bit sad. Now, I have to admit, if you took away both those elements, you know, if we didn't have any external force and the guy was just horrible because he's a guy, that would be quite a hard watch. It could work, but it'd be a, like, I don't know, like a Ray Winston, Ken Loach kind of misery.
I think part of the problem is that, particularly in a film, it's nice to have something like motivations for the villain in particular. And, you know, it's a long and baroque plan to get hold of the jewels.
It is.
But it's at least a plan that makes some sort of sense. Whereas I'm just doing this, it's a slice of life, would leave one feeling, quite frankly, tired.
Yeah, and depressed. And it's still kind of laudable in the sense that I wonder if this was the first time kind of toxic relation, or one of the first times toxic relationships were explored in films. And even though we've got a sort of trite sort of murder mystery framing device for it, I still think it's useful and would have been helpful for people in similar situations to see that sort of thing can be done. I'm just slightly disappointed that it needs that motivation. But I agree with you. Perhaps I'm complaining too much there. I suppose it's similar to my gut reaction with murder mysteries in a way, in that I appreciate the kind of the clockwork of it in the interest, but I feel like murder isn't like that in reality. And that slightly distanced me from enjoyment of it. And I think I get a similar sort of vibe here in that you don't need all this Agatha Christie stuff to make that relationship a believable one. But that's, that said, I think you're right. That would be a much harder film to watch.
I do suddenly realise why he has to be a bigamist. Because particularly under the production code, you certainly can't show a husband abusing his wife. But you say at the end, don't worry, kids, it wasn't really a husband, so it's all right.
the Angela Lansbury Nancy is less explicitly up for it. She's much more subtly played.
Yeah, I found while watching, I thought her more obvious, but
but
she's being a bit more reserved about it, and she's making it clear that availability could be a thing that happened, but she's definitely looking out for herself rather than just throwing herself at the guy.
Yes, I think maybe there's reserved.
One moment when she steps out to hail a cab. There's just that beautifully impudent curtsy he and she are getting into the cab and she's left on the pavement. And yeah.
Yeah, it's really, yes, I agree. In some ways, the body language is a bit more, obvious, but Yeah.
What did strike me watching them in fairly quick succession is the 1940 is very clearly an adaptation of a play. And we do get scene changes, but it's sparing of them. There's a lot happening in the same places and often from the same camera angles. Whereas the 44, and obviously to some extent this is you've got a Hollywood budget to work with.
This had a much higher budget.
We're quite prepared to change scenes, change cameras. We see, I guess, whatever. We see the guy hunting around in the attic, climbing in and out through the skylight, that kind of thing.
Yes.
And indeed, there are long sequences with no dialogue at all, just as things are happening in a non-verbal way, which really doesn't happen much in the 1940.
Yeah, that's true. There's more focus on the cinema of it. It's funny that, as you mention it, yes, very quickly those things just pass me by and I just sink into the story. So I don't, as you mention it, yes, I agree, though I didn't. I'd be lying if I said I really noticed that during the films, but you're absolutely right. It's, you know, there's a lot more, like they go to the Tower of London and they actually go to the ball. It is much more filmic.
Also in 1944, we have one extra character, bloodthirsty Bessie Thwaite. who's basically, Paula meets her by chance on a train when she's running off to elope.
A version of that character is basically in every film that was ever made in the 40s, in the 30s. She's straight out of an Ealing comedy, really. My problem with Betty Thwaites is that from the moment she first said, "Well," I just knew the film was going to end with her saying, "Well," it's slightly, I was waiting for it the whole time. Not that I didn't appreciate it. It's very nice. The kind of the 44 equivalent of fuck me. I did appreciate it. She's a fun character. I like her.
Also played by the fine Mae Whitty.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, she's wonderful in this. I just wish she'd met Inspector Ruff. They would have had a lot in common. They would
yeah.
Good bit of conversation.
Yeah, then they would have stolen the film.
That's true. That's the spin-off we want to see, Betty and Ruff. They could have called it A Bit of Ruff. Could have been an Ealing comedy. There we go. Are. I mean,
would just like to mention in passing, one of the things that's established here is our police inspector, to find out more about what's going on, realizes that the maid is clearly a bit up for anything and gets one of his constables, having established first that he is not a married man, to flirt with her. That constable is played by Tom Stevenson, minor actor of the period, and I'm really curious what anybody thinks his accent was meant to be.
it put me in mind of Leonard Nimoy's Australian accent, which is in one of the, I think it might be in one of the Man for Uncle things. It is a wandering accent. I don't know where he's from originally. It sounded to me like he was Australian trying to do Victorian London.
Well, Stevenson was born and died in California. I don't know where he was in between.
Oh, God. Well, wherever he was, he went to some strange places because that was a peculiar accent, I have to say.
Also, Roger's Music Corner, we get another instance of The Last Rose of Summer here, which is actually used as something of a theme because it was the aunt's particular song.
So what what were your favourite elements from both films then, and which worked and which didn't?
Well, I do want to talk about the acting of the 1940, because I noticed a thing when I was looking at the backgrounds. Anton Walbrook and Diana Wynyard are the leads, and in 1939, they were both starring in Design for Living at the Haymarket, along with some guy named Rex Harrison. You've probably never heard of him.
Oh yeah, well, he never went anywhere, did he?
But they, you know, 200 plus performances. They're clearly very comfortable with each other.
Yes.
By the time they're making this film, and I do think that shows. Charles Boyer, not bad. Ingrid Bergman, great, of course. But I didn't get quite that same feeling of. We have that natural trust of each other, that which is being subverted.
It worked, but I will point out again, Charles Boyer, once again, a foreigner in the second film.
Yes, to be fair, given Birdman's accent, she is also a foreigner.
Yes, so. That's true. That's true. fair point. I think the chemistry in the second film worked best for me because I could see how these two got together. Whereas the first one was a bit more like, I don't know, Basil and Sybil Fawlty. They hated each other right from the start.
I mean, the backstory is the same, that he is doing it explicitly to get into the house, but...
Now, I think the 40s version is much closer to the play, is it?
I'm not detailed familiar with the play.
Okay. I got that impression reading around it, but I think overall, the 44 version, there are elements of the 40 version and the 40 film that I liked, particularly Rough. But overall, the 44 version worked better. I think it was a wise choice to show them before. Mm. I think it was a wise choice.
Yes, that's the essential part of the 44 for me.
Yes, I think so. And it may be, you know, I'm being a bit mean on Anton Walbrook. If he was given the opportunity, he just never turns on any charm in the way that Charles Boyer does. And so I never quite understand why. And maybe that's me being unfair, you know, that there are relationships where that, you know, you meet people and you think, why is she with him?
But I certainly found myself thinking, yeah, I think this one's 1875, it's 18 something anyway. And yeah, this is the way a lot of people, but even outsiders, will expect a marriage to look.
Yeah, yeah. That's fair.
Whereas in 44, it's more plausibly, oh, they're in love, they ran away together. And then it is changing gradually rather than... Yeah.
And I think you hit on a nice moment where you're like, he really does do the, don't worry, I'm looking out for you. We'll just be aware that these things are happening to you. I'm going to, you know, we'll make sure. We'll deal with it. I thought that was better. There's a moment of kindness and that draws her in. And then you can see that she's working towards getting that again.
Of them end up with him setting up to have her committed.
Oh yes, yeah, and it's this all the action happens on the, I think in both cases, on the eve of them actually being committed.
Mm. Because yeah, at this date, yeah, pretty much you are a well-spoken man. You get a doctor or two on your side, and it really is not going to be difficult to get somebody locked away forever.
And certainly in 44, he tells her. She's an orphan. She didn't know what happened to her parents, but he lies to her and tells her that her mother died in an asylum. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he adds that kind of turn of the screw as well. I mean, I think they're both great films. I genuinely do. I think for me, the second version is the masterpiece.
Yeah. I mean, it was the obvious way to bet, but I would agree. On the other hand, I'm very glad we've got the 1940 as well. I think it does things interestingly differently.
Yes, I really enjoyed both of them. And if we didn't have the 44 version, I'd think the 40 was a masterpiece. It's also one of those films, because it's become, you know, modern parlance, I sort of felt, I kind of knew what was going to happen in the film. So it was always nice actually to see a film where you're like, oh no, there's more to it than just this. That's just the sort of the central theme. But there's still, you know, there's interesting things to watch and say about it. I'm very glad we've watched both of them and glad both exist. But certainly, this isn't a version. What was that first version of the Maltese Falcon? Death Comes Up for a Lady or something? What was it called?
Oh, no, the first one was the Maltese Falcon. And then there was, I've lost it now. But
it was the Bette Davis one. That was a bad one.
Like Satan Met a Lady.
Satan Met a Lady. That's a terrible film. But here, you know, they're not duffers. They're both very good. I just think the 44 version, you know, Ingrid Bergman was a star for a reason. I haven't seen much of Ingrid Bergman outside Casablanca, so it's nice to see her elsewhere.
This time round, I don't think I'd seen the 1940 before, but I watched it first to try to get the idea of, you know, this is what an audience of the time coming to it, not necessarily knowing about it, might have felt. And my feeling at the time was, yeah, this is good stuff, but it's not really a classic. It's good. Yeah. Whereas the 44, yes, I can see why this is a classic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yes, a lot of it is Ingrid Bergman. She has that, all right, it's a histrionic emotional range, but it is a range. This is not just screamy.
Yes, exactly. It's a proper descent. You know, that scream that she does at the end is the culmination of the film, of her mental breakdown, and I think she earned it. Whereas Diana Wynyard's much more buttoned down and quietly distressed. It's probably more realistic in a, well, I don't know. I think behind Victorian closed doors there are a lot of screaming, probably. Very good. My sort of queasiness aside about the need to explain away this behaviour because he was a jewel thief, I think I'm being unfair on the film, but I think that's more my own personal issue. But though, but I'm very glad we watched both of them.
Mm.
Very good. Very good stuff. Not that you listened to any of this, you imagined it. Now just go to sleep and don't worry about it. And any noises you hear are merely figments of your imagination. Oh,